All right, everybody, welcome to the February 3rd edition of Cascadian Views. We have a new guest this week. I'm joined by our usual crew of Dan and JJ. We also have Chris LeMay West with us from our Facebook group, who's been doing an excellent job chronicling the Russia investigation. How are you guys all doing tonight?
Hello, hello.
Doing well.
Doing all right. Yeah.
All right. Sweet. We had a rather eventful week this week. There's going to be a lot to talk about. The memo from the Republican investigation in the House was released without the accompanying Democratic rebuttal. There's been some movement around Deputy Director McCabe. The State of the Union happened. Trump's first official State of the Union. What happened last week was, in the most pedantic sense, not a State of the Union. Or what happened last year, excuse me. We're going to go through that speech, what happened in that. Washington is proposing a carbon tax, which looks like it's going to go through. Oregon looks like it's going to join the National Popular Vote Compact. And JJ, you had a link about homeless policy in LA. I thought that was a great start because we also had a little bit of a sweep here in Portland this week. So with that all said.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Yes, the LA Times put out what I thought was a pretty good piece about LA's homelessness, though they also had a few ties to other major cities in the country and also in the region, just for the West Coast. Big headline was that their homelessness has surged 75% in 6 years. So their total is somewhere in the 55,000 range. And three out of four of those people have no shelter, or rather live in cars, campers, tents, you know, no shelter access. And LA has, as this article goes through, pretty much one of the worst ratios for beds to people. Seattle's rocking somewhere around 65% beds for people, though, as the chart shows, not all of those actually get into shelters. I was shocked by New York City. I'm not sure if you guys are looking at the graph, but New York City seems to be at almost 100% of homeless people sheltered, which seems impossible given what I think their homeless problem must look like.
They've actually been really good on those stats for a while. I don't know if that accurately reflects the real-world situation, but of the people that the New York Department of Health has contacted who are homeless, they get the vast majority of them into shelters.
Okay. I mean, and that was kind of part of my curiosity, is how they were measuring and, you know, in what way are they compiling their data so that they can say that.
They don't have 100%. I doubt they ever could. There's too many nooks and crannies. I don't even know if the mole people are a thing or if that was a hoax or what. But, yeah, of the people the city makes contact with, they are almost universally sheltered into various facilities.
What this chart suggests, which was just really surprising. Yeah. I mean, but awesome. I mean, if true, then wow, way to go, New York City.
Yeah, I wasn't actually expecting to talk about this quite so quick. JJ, you got, as Obama would say, out in front of your skis a little bit. We transitioned very quickly into this article.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I thought that was what we were doing.
I was just going through the rundown. But yeah, no, I'm actually quite happy to talk about this. We had Kieran Portland. Just this week, a new self-managed homeless campsite set up out in an area called the Columbia Slough. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But it was the topic of about 2 weeks' worth of Oregonian coverage last year. The Slough was, it was called Tweaker Island in that bit of coverage. And just the,
a lovely and endearing name.
Yeah. And it was at times heartbreaking and at times hopeful, like, look into the lives of the people who were camped out on this, like, just spit of land that various groups were arguing over who had possession, and nobody really wanted to have the possession because it was former industrial land and there was going to have to be cleanup. And they just found a hole in the wall, basically. Now, a year later, they've come through and they've started cleaning it up. They've started making actual tent, like, you know, pads to get people up off the ground. Started a whole new little village out there and basically dared the mayor to come do something about it. And it took 48 hours for the cops to come do something about it.
That was going to be my next question, because I know the Bay Area has had several situations like that, and inevitably they get raided sooner or later.
The city actually has, in the past, worked with some of these. They have a long partnership with a camp called Right to Dream 2, which we have talked about in previous shows, specifically about their actual lease situation and a patch that they're trying to move into out by the Moda Center and whatnot. So there was some suggestion that maybe the city might work with these people, but the fact that they didn't get any guidance from the city at all and then called the newspaper, gave TV interviews, and dared the mayor to do something about it worked out about as well as you would expect on that, which is sad because these self-managed camps do help. Right to Dream 2 has been a huge positive in terms of what they're able to accomplish.
I'm very interested looking at this graph. Where San Francisco is on the graph does not surprise me. I'm originally from Northern California. I lived in San Francisco for a long time. But what does surprise me, like JJ was saying, is New York, because in many ways San Francisco is similar. You know, a very densely urban space, a space where you don't really have open land that you can set up new things in. This makes me think that if New York found something that worked, I wonder if it would work in San Francisco.
I think there are two big issues at this, and one is climate. The cities where there are fewer homeless people housed tend to be cities that have milder winters that are basically places where you can go out and live in the woods if you so choose. In terms of San Francisco, the Central Park in New York City was actually modeled after the Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. And there are camps of people who live in that park, and they've been featured. In fact, during the dot-com boom, there were people who were running companies out of Starbucks and then living in tents at Golden Gate Park at night.
Right.
And yeah, Salt Lake City, New York City, these are all cities with pretty severe winters, and shelter seems to be more of a actual survival need than, you know, in, say, a San Francisco.
But, I mean, all the same, like, given the way in which the Bay Area thinks about itself, and San Francisco in particular, and, you know, granted that that's changed, of course, pretty significantly in the past 10 years, 15 years, but, you know, it thinks of itself as so much more progressive than New York City that it's kind of... It is surprising to me that if there was something that is working seemingly as well, that, like, you know, Project Homeless out of the Bay Area couldn't find, you know, somebody else to buy in on the city or county level to try to duplicate.
I think you're going to see some of that happen. In San Francisco, they had a city policy for a long time about housing first. Whatever issues somebody has, whatever mental health issues, whatever addictions, get them into housing, and the rest will kind of fall into place, whether it be alcohol abuse or substance abuse. And I that was kind of a centerpiece of Newsom's mayoralship. So I don't really know how it's worked out since then. I've left the city, obviously, so I don't have any on-the-ground knowledge. But it'd be interesting to see where San Francisco has evolved on that issue. All
right. Yeah, for sure.
Let's go back to our national news here. I'll probably chop up the video and post to put that section towards the end. But, I want to talk about the investigations. Let's start with the memo, because I think that's going to be a nice little branching off point. The much ballyhooed Republican memo from the House Intelligence Committee, the one David Nunes has been crowing about for days and days and days, has come out. Have you read it? Has anybody read it?
Yeah, we looked through it.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't take long.
I definitely read it. It says, well, it says the opposite of what Nunes said it says. It says very specifically that the investigation began as a consequence of Papadopoulos bragging to an Australian ambassador, and not at all that the investigation began with this dossier. So this is probably the most hyped nothing burger I have ever seen in my life, and I think that we don't, you know, I think that we overuse the phrase nothing burger, but nothing in my experience can come close to this. There was precisely zero of value in this memo, except for the fact that Carter Page is a douchebag.
Right. Something that was certainly public knowledge already.
And by the way, some breaking news today. Carter Page bragged about being an advisor to, and I'm quoting, the Kremlin, in 2013.
I saw that.
Not even an ambassador to the Russian government, or advisor to the Russian government. He said he was advising the Kremlin. This is the hill that they've chosen to die on. Carter Page's credibility is where House Republicans have staked their flag.
This, well, not so much his credibility, but the rampant abuse of power against Carter Page, who has clearly been the victim of a massive conspiracy going back years and years, well before he had anything to do with Donald Trump. So, of course, that's what's happening here.
Chris.
See, that's how good the FBI are, man. They got Carter Page on pre-crime like 10 years ago. We've just been waiting for everything to catch up for it now.
Chris, yes. This investigation has really kind of been focusing down. We're starting to get indictments. Trump is starting to get worried on all this. Can you kind of run us through, where do we stand on this? How close to the end do you think Mueller is, and what do you think he knows?
Yeah, I don't know if he's close to the ultimate end, because there's so many things to follow up on, but there certainly are indications that he's close to some kind of an end that involves questioning Trump directly. And, you know, the kind of sense of that is that it's probably specifically around the obstruction of justice issues, because he's been talking to Sessions, he's been talking to Bannon, he's been talking to everybody he would need to talk to know about Comey's firing, to know about the circumstances in which Flynn was let go in, and who knew what at what point. And his team has also explicitly been negotiating with the Trump team about the kind of, you know, ways and means of when they'll sit down.
Trump has given kind of mixed signals on that. He's told the news media that he'd be happy to talk, under oath, in fact. He volunteered that little bit himself. While his lawyers are busy saying that they don't believe anything in the investigation has reached, you know, anywhere close enough to Trump for him to be deposed and that sort of thing, it seems like they're talking out of both sides of their mouth.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, a classic Trumpism, which is, he said what was on his mind at that moment, and then the people who actually know what's up had to immediately step in and recharacterize
it. Oh, the president couldn't possibly mean that. That that would be bad. No, something else. He'll get back to you.
Well, and there have been some articles out which, you know, kind of go through the history, because, as we know, Trump is very litigation happy and also is very prone to stiffing people, so he's been in court a lot over the last 10 years. And he is a terrible witness. Like, he meanders,
oh, really?
Contradicts himself, he incriminates himself. So I think his team is justifiably worried.
Wow. I think he really can't pay them enough. That's like possibly the only lawyers who won't make enough money for the pile of crap that they'll have to eat.
Yeah, I mean, what makes him a bad witness especially is that I don't think he's really aware that he's a terrible witness and that he's likely to get himself in horrible trouble. He's just so self-unaware, and I think his attorneys are trying to protect him from himself, but every time he talks to the press, it's going to be, I can handle it. I'm the biggest swaggering dick in Washington, D.C. So Bring on Mueller.
The legal thing, right? I mean, the legal thing is you should always answer the question, exactly the question they asked you, and answer it in as few words as possible, and don't volunteer anything else beyond that answer, which is totally the opposite of how he speaks, whenever his speaking isn't structured and coached by someone else.
There was a great scene in The West Wing that really drove that in, where Babish asked CJ if she knows what time it is. She tells him the time, and he tells her he wishes she would stop doing that. She says, what? Right. And he says, answering more than you were asked. And he repeats the question, and she says, yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It almost makes me feel like we should petition Rosie O'Donnell to just ask Trump really specific legal questions that might involve the case. Like, you know, Robert Mueller, just like, ship your list of questions to Rosie O'Donnell, and she'll hit him up over Twitter, and he just won't be able to help himself.
Wait, is there something going on between Trump and Rosie?
Well, I mean, kind of perpetually since...
Yeah, that's been years.
Like, what, the 90s?
Okay. I was just curious what was going on.
He hates her. Like, they like, hardcore feuded for, I think, the better part of a decade. So she's just, like, one of the people that will easily get under his skin.
Yeah. I think you're as likely to get Trump to admit to blatant obstruction, collusion, everything you can think of, you know, just by asking him the time, literally, because he goes on these tangents and gets around and around and around to whatever point besides what you're actually asking him.
The other little bit to this story, specifically as it relates to the last few weeks, was that Deputy Director McCabe has been forced out of the FBI. McCabe may very well be a witness to obstruction. Trump forced the resignation. McCabe was only about 4 months away from a planned retirement anyway, which makes me wonder why Trump didn't just sit on his hands for a few months and let the guy walk out the door.
I'm a little worried it's a test run for Rosenstein and then Mueller.
Yeah, that was kind of my concern. Like, what exactly happened in the room right before the forced resignation? Like, what were the conversations that happened that week and the week before?
Yeah. Well, I also think there's a... I wondered if some aspect of it wasn't Trump's, you know, which we've seen several times, his kind of interest in humiliating people. It's not enough that he gets what he wants or he breaks them or whatever, but, you know, McCabe was kind of saying, like, oh, I'm going to retire in a few months, here's the set date, and that's when my pension vests, and...
Yeah, oh god, and like, rather than just, like, let him retire with dignity, like, no, I gotta shit can you. I mean, and there were the stories about McCabe, so he was in the papers, and that, of course, I'm sure always ruffles Trump whenever somebody else is in the papers.
Ken posted it.
And Trump loses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ken posted a I thought, wonderfully enlightening little clip about a conversation, I believe it was with McCabe, that Trump had, where he was pissed off that Comey got a ride back on the FBI plane.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, that was it.
And then when McCabe said nobody asked him, but, you know, if they had, he would have given the okay, Trump was like, ask your wife how it feels to be a loser. Yeah, you're right, 100% humiliation. It's what he thrives on.
Yeah,
it's like a fucking kindergarten.
Has to. Yeah. Yeah, like a bully in kindergarten. Yes.
All right. So we're going to pivot in just a moment to the State of the Union. But, Chris, I want to ask two things. One, how soon do you feel we're going to have an official request to depose Trump? How long before Mueller wants to talk to him on the record? Is that coming up by the end of the week, by the end of the month, by summer?
I think much sooner than summer. I mean, by all indications, they were looking for something within a few weeks when they started talking a week or two ago. And the only thing that I think might delay that is if this, you know, spree of discrediting and firing people gets more volatile.
There was a wonderful quote on Twitter from a journalist I follow. I can't remember the name now. I apologize for that. But that the memo wasn't meant to actually be anything informative. It was meant to be a fig leaf. If there are, you know, 34 senators out there who decide they don't want to impeach Trump, it gives them an excuse. And I'm really hoping, because the other possibility is terrifying, but I'm hoping that this memo was just too blatantly nothing to really sustain that, because otherwise we're going to have a clash. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in the State of the Union, because one of the scariest things that came out of that speech was Trump asking for secretaries, cabinet secretaries, to have the right to fire career civil service staff. We made jokes about purges. Some of them weren't even jokes. Some Republican House members were openly calling for them. But now Trump is asking for the legal right to purge agencies of non-political staff. And that is fucking terrifying.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and just to touch on the memo one last thing. I mean, even though, you know, we're joking about it and it seems perpetually no big deal to us, I'm sure that it's playing very, very different on the Republican side for people who already don't think that much of this investigation is that valid.
Oh, yeah. Sean Hannity's calling for all charges to be dropped against Manafort and Gates.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that it's just, you know, to us, yeah, oh, man, it's slam dunk and it's a nothing burger. But from the other side, it's... this is probably very, very damning of the FBI to people who aren't in the know, aren't reading, aren't, you know, paying attention to this from a Democratic point of view.
Or, I'll pass on the link on this, but there was actually some polling released, you know, that shows that a majority polling released overnight, but this trend has been going on for a while. But at this point, the majority of Republicans do not trust the FBI.
Oh, that's insane. Yeah.
That is the worst possible outcome.
Not to take, like, a really temporarily douchey turn and look at the politics of this, but, like, man, it would be really easy to ding them on the Law and Order Party at this point in time when nobody likes Law and Order, apparently. Or when it polls poorly amongst the GOP electorate.
But... where was it? I saw on Sean King's Facebook feed the point that basically they're all for law and order when it's fascist local cops going out and killing black men and getting no consequence for it. But the elite law enforcement of the country, that we can't have. That is treasonous.
Yeah, excellent point. Indeed.
The other bit of the State of the Union that terrified me a little bit was Trump, and he knew this would be controversial, I think, because he prefaced it with a big bold "when appropriate" in front of it. But he basically proposed privatizing our infrastructure. When talking about how we need to get new bridges and highways and roads built, he said that they get the best deal by leveraging public money in partnership with private companies.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I guess I can say this and have it not be, you know, blowing things out of proportion, but he really is advocating fascism. And I mean that in, like, literally Mussolini's fascist party, the uniting of state and corporation, like, you know, what you'd said, giving cabinet secretaries the ability to just fire or promote at will, as Dan rightfully said in the comment on the Facebook page, just roll 150 years of professionalization in the civil service, like, taking everything out of what has made public service, like, possible and reasonable and a good place to work. and putting everybody under the same kind of scary situations that they find in private business.
You know, at least Mussolini got the trains to run on time. TriMet's trains can't even get here with any sort of regularity, so I might be okay with Mussolini for a while.
Yeah, but that's because you're part of the left coast. I mean, you know, the authoritarianism hasn't graced Portland in totality yet, you know. Once Trump's tiny fingers are on you, you know, you'll just walk everywhere.
Yeah.
Or take an Uber, actually. There won't be trains. You'll just have to Uber everywhere.
Privatized.
Because you can't take taxis because they'll have unions and those are right out. So, Uber's all the way.
Yeah. The other bit of the State of the Union that really made waves around the country was the immigration section, which was, well, it was enough to give you whiplash. Trump spent the first half of it absolutely trashing immigrants, trashing dreamers. In fact, he even made a very deliberate point. Somebody said it was vintage Stephen Miller when saying that the Dreamers were murderers for MS-13 brought here by Loophole as dangerous unaccompanied minors. Really just being as sympathetic as possibly could right there. I mean, what better light to paint these people in? Following which he said that he was going to protect border communities because Americans are Dreamers too. Which is really just, you know, opening their mouth and putting out your cigarette right on their tongue. I'm sure it felt great for any young people watching that, wondering what their immigration status is going to be in just a few months. It was spiteful. It was mean and spiteful. And that was really, I think, the defining part of this immigration speech. And then he tried to pull it back. And it was noted in a lot of analysis that he may have done the first really mean, really spiteful part of the speech in order to prepare his base for what he was going to do in the second half, which was a completely unconvincing offer to the Dreamers, which basically boils down to have enough money to go to college, don't be what we consider a bad American for 12 years, and at the end of it, if we feel like it, you might get citizenship.
It's kind of telling to me that he has to kind of sweeten the pot with a lot of hate before even coming up with something that awful and stingy.
Yeah.
That's where his base is at.
Yeah, that is 100% where his base is at.
Yeah, I mean, if it's not full-throated 100% hate train, then, I mean, you're just a cuck, Dan.
Yeah, Tommy Libtard.
Yeah, there we go. Call me libtards.
Well, you know, even as long, as far back as the Bush era, what would have been a pretty bipartisan immigration plan could not get through certain congressional Republicans even then. And we know how much this kind of racially tinged sentiment has been pumped up during the Obama years since then.
Right.
The anti-immigration antithesis in the Republican Party has been around for a while, and it kind of dates back to the Reagan amnesty and what they felt was like a really raw deal that they got from that. I mean, this has been kind of a defining part of the Republican Party for at least since the early 90s or so.
It's been an undercurrent since the 90s. I mean, that was when you had the big Pat Buchanan campaigns in 92 and 96, and, you know, they were very, very hardcore anti-immigrant, although Trump's made that mainstream, basically. I mean, that was the platform that he ran on in 2016. So, yeah, times have changed, and not for the better on that front.
I'm fairly curious as to whether or not if the midterm elections go the way that I think they're going to go, and we at least take the House on the Democratic side, and possibly even the Senate, I'm curious to see how far Trump tries to go Sisyphean on his wall, if this becomes like a crusade for him.
Hmm.
mean, I think to the Ann Coulter quote from, man, it would be early 2016, when he was, yeah, when he was still a candidate, you know, during the primaries. She said, you know, so as long as he maintains the line, like that hard line on immigration, he'll continue to get voted in. As soon as he wavers from that path, he loses his base, he loses, like, the whole thing crumbles. Like, that's become the one issue by which the GOP has entirely united, you know, the three or four rabid sides that compose the extreme fringes of the Republican Party that have now eaten into the center of the cake.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, a lot of times throughout this last year, people have asked what he would have to do to lose his support. I think that's really it.
Yeah, I mean, Ann Coulter was dead sure. Like, that's the only thing. He can break any other rule, any other law, but if he maintains that policy, no matter the ridiculous end, he won't lose the GOP.
Ann Coulter has predicted that Trump has lost his base, though, like 6 or 7 times in his presidency.
Oh, yeah, but that's every time that he says anything less than Holocaust levels of immigration policy.
Yeah, exactly. She comes to Twitter and is like, Trump can kiss his base goodbye. And, you know, she's going to be right one of these times, but I don't feel like giving her... She predicts doom whenever he says something she doesn't like. It's basically her entire job as a pundit. I don't really necessarily trust her judgment.
I never have. I definitely can't see the kind of Breitbart crowd. There's a lot of things where, because it's Trump, we're now okay with it. But the immigration stuff is so kind of central to their whole take on America that I can't see them turning on that.
Yeah.
As the cult of personality progresses, I'd be interested in seeing if that ever slides the other way.
Like, if he could somehow turn the whole GOP on that issue?
Yeah. Not even, like, necessarily intentionally, because I don't think he plans things out that far, but just if he needs to flip for some deal that he wants to make, if his personality cult is ingrained enough, he might be able to make that happen at some point. It'll be some stupid deal.
I would say so, yes.
It'll be like he gives up his wall and hating brown people for, I don't know, his next $500 million in Mar-a-Lago profits are tax-free. But I could, yeah. You know, not that would pass constitutional muster.
Or like, he'll allow immigration into this country, but instead of, you know, the island outside of New York City, like, you'll have to, like, all immigrations and customs will go through his own, like, his golf courses.
That would never fly. The only brown people allowed are caddies.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what they have to do first. It's indentured servitude.
Exactly.
All right. We're going to flip this around to our local batch. We have two primary stories this week. One, Washington State might actually get a carbon tax. This was a proposal a couple of years ago. It went down in both the legislature and the ballot initiative, I believe. But it's showing new signs of life. Dan, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is something that Governor Inslee has been campaigning on basically since he was elected governor, I think probably when he was in the House as well. But what he's been pushing for a long time is he had some form of a carbon tax, some effort to reduce the use of fossil fuels in the state, or at least price it into our economy. And as you mentioned, that's been dead on arrival for pretty much the entirety of his governorship so far, partly because we've had a divided legislature since, I want to say, 2011 or possibly 2013. Where the Republicans have controlled the Senate by a narrow margin with a handful of Democratic turncoats. And then, of course, in 2016, certain groups tried to get a bill, I guess a voter initiative through creating a carbon tax. That one ended up being a little bit more controversial. There was actually a lot of infighting in the environmental community over how it was done, concerns that a lot of the replacements and set-asides in the bill were, you know, regressive and falling too hard on the poor. But, yeah, as of November, when control of the Senate finally flipped over to the Democrats, you know, the question has been for some time is what they're going to do with that power. And, yeah, this bill to create a, let's see here, the specific amount, I believe it was $10 per, gosh, what's the amount?
Per ton. $10 per ton. Yeah,
$10 per ton has made movement through the Senate committee, actually, the Senate Energy Committee, and is moving on to Ways and Means. So, I mean, that's going to be one of the last stops before it is approaching the floor. And I think the Senate is probably going to be the harder hurdle to come through. The Democrats have a, you know, in both chambers, they've got just a one-seat majority. But generally, the House is still considered the more liberal body. So I think if they can get it through the Senate first, then they have a real chance of actually getting this through and probably achieving the – this would be the most significant part of Inslee's legacy, I'd say, for his entire governorship, if they can actually do it.
The article you linked from the Seattle Times notes that it starts as $10 a ton, but then it's going to climb by $2 a year until it reaches $30.
So, yeah, phasing in over time. And, of course, hopefully more and more energy that's being used is going to be coming from renewable sources, non-use of carbon. Actually, the state doesn't produce any carbon-based energy internally. Anything that's used in that way is imported. But, yeah, to the extent that it can be reduced for all use, including for gasoline, that's going to be huge.
All right. The other thing that I'm a little bit curious about in this, what sources of carbon are being taxed? Is it everything in the business chain? The article, and I'm asking this, I don't necessarily know if you have any specific information, but since this has been a topic in Washington's politics for some years now, I figure there's some similarities among all the proposals. But the one the article specifically mentions is gas, and it's going to be equivalent to, at the $10 a ton, a 9-cent tax per gallon of gasoline. At $30 a ton, that would obviously rise to about 18, 20 cents. Gasoline is but one of many, many carbon sources in various industries. Are we really focused on just the gas, or is this going to look at like a business's entire operation?
I would expect it to be on the entire operations of a business or any use of, yeah, carbon-based fuels. Because otherwise, yeah, I mean, consumer gasoline is probably one of the largest uses of carbon, you know, carbon-based fuels. But, of course, industry is going to be making use of that as well. So, yeah, I would expect to be effective. It's going to have to be broad-based and cover all aspects of the business chain.
The other bid we're going to talk about on our local section is kind of a pet issue for me. The National Popular Vote the National Interstate Popular Vote Compact is a group of states that have all passed legally binding constitutional amendments or legal proposals to the legislatures that kick into effect when enough states have joined, that they form a majority of the Electoral College. At that point, those states that have so agreed would dispense their electoral votes to the winner of the national popular vote. Washington is already on board with this. You guys have been for a while. Oregon was the last state on the West Coast, well, the contiguous West Coast, that had not signed on to this proposal. We are coming very, very close. It has been held up for a long time by a Democratic legislator who was rather uneasy with the proposal. He has now relented. and let it through. He was our Senate president, Peter Courtney. His one condition was he wants to see it on the ballot. People have to agree. But
I'm curious, what was the source of his reservations about it?
He felt it was undemocratic for the state. We would be allowing other states to determine how we're going to apportion our vote, which I actually see. But, you know, when we've watched two elections in the last, what now, five, go to the person who lost the popular vote, I think it, you know, brings it into sharper focus, and giving people a chance to agree with it at the ballot box probably takes away a lot of the undemocratic feelings he has about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the also, to go further into the article, he's also being barraged by Cash for his opponent about this issue specifically. And it's not going to win many friends up here in Oregon, but it is a California-based group. And being a California-based person who moved to Oregon, I have long ago learned that I am the shit stain on the bottom of your shoe.
Is he still running for re-election? I mean, Courtney's pretty old. He's been around a long
time. He is 100% still running.
Wow.
Yeah, no, he is...
Dan, just look at that grizzled face. Of course that man is never going to stop running.
Well, sure, I guess once you're there, why not? But
I don't even necessarily think he looks that old, but he definitely looks like he's ate breakfast at Carl's Jr. every day for the last 34 years. That is my read of that face.
Like, he's got his own personal Denny's.
Right.
He is the representative from Salem, which is our capital. He's probably got his seat for as long as he wants it. Although, like I said, the California group has propped nearly $100,000 worth of spending for his opponent. $100,000 in a state legislator seat is a lot.
There's a fair amount of Republican votes when you get out into Marion County outside of Salem proper, so... I mean, it's not completely safe, but yeah.
All right. Well, that's just about going to wrap it up. Chris, I'm thankfully stayed with. We usually end this with a story that we're going to be following for this next week. I'm going to go ahead and jump out on the first one here, just because it's been something that ties in with my other major focus, and that is college sports. I love them. The U.S. gymnastics scandal, which ended, maybe not ended, but the most dramatic part ended this week with the sentencing of former team doctor to basically infinity years in prison. One of the fathers of the girls he abused attempted to assault him in court. Don't even hold it against the man, although I'm not that in favor of vigilante justice, but the university, Michigan State University, MSU, has really lost everything in this. They've lost their athletic director. They've lost a majority of their board. The school's getting right through the coals, and quite appropriately so. If there is one place where the Me Too movement really needs to take hold, It's colleges and academia. People need to feel free to question limits and not be bound by assholes who just feel like they can take advantage of people. I'm pleased that Michigan State is cleaning house. I'm interested to see if this is an actual change of heart and an attempt to address the issues, or if it's just something they're going to try and do for a couple months and gloss over. But with all the attention that this has been getting lately, seeing actual results and actual changes would be very refreshing. So that's what I'm going to be following along with. Dan, how about you? What are you looking for this week?
All right. So this is another kind of local issue that I'd be following. But net neutrality and local efforts to restore it after the FCC ended up revoking the protections, or at least taking steps to do so a few weeks ago. My own state senator, actually, Kevin Ranker, who represents parts of Whatcom and Skagit County and the San Juan Islands, has introduced a bill to restore it on a local basis within Washington State. And there are companion bills in the House that actually have a fair amount of bipartisan support. This is a state that has made a lot of its fortunes on the technological community and technological business. So I think there's hope that there can be bipartisan support to actually get something like this through and restore some of the protections that have been taken away at the federal level, at least around here. It doesn't do much for places like, you know, Mississippi, which, you know, they have their own local governments to deal with. But at least that's something. And it's an issue that's, you know, cropped up in some surprising places. I think a few weeks ago, I want to say it was Montana, where the governor put through an executive order to restore regulations locally.
So, and New York has done similarly as well, I think, last week.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, it's not ideal that we have to deal with this through the laboratories of democracy, but at least it means some local protections here on the left coast. And I guess we get our regulated and non-corporate strangled internet even before the Great Secession of Cascadia.
All right. How about you, JJ? What are you looking for this week?
Slightly piggybacking on Dan's thing, wonderfully coincidentally, but with a bit of an international look. I found a story about Europe's general data protection regulation. So the EU as a bloc has passed this regulation. It starts in May and is considerably more favorable to users and has a lot more privacy protections. So some of the things that are going to change, let's see. I forgot, where was it? The EU consumers will be able to pull their data from a company at any time, which I am pretty sure, you know, for individual users will mean, like, destroying Facebook accounts, Google accounts, and actually having those sorts of things not be stored. They can force businesses to alert customers within 3 days if their data is hacked, which, of course, there are no such regulations in the States of anywhere remotely near that number. And finally, let people move information to rival services immediately as well, where there are often a lot of terms and conditions, wait times, and not necessarily any guarantee that your data was actually fully relocated and deleted from, you know, the previous services servers. So, you know, this will be a really big thing because, as the article points out, Europe is the biggest trading bloc in the world. So this kind of effect, you know, this kind of push is going to have effects in other countries all across the world as it hopefully, you know, makes it a little bit closer and easier for this to become a common practice.
All right. That's actually definitely something I'm going to look forward to on that as well.
Yeah, right? Yeah. You'll enjoy that story, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, Chris, what about you? What are you following this week?
Gosh, you guys had such good kind of local issues that I feel like I should have one. And, you know, don't totally give up on that because our state legislature is in session now, and I'm actually going to a legislative breakfast with a couple of our reps on Monday morning, so maybe I'll come up with one. But what I'm really kind of keyed in on is I want to see what the next step of this whole memo fallout is. I think the press, for those who care to see it, is so successfully deconstructing the memo that I'm not sure there's really a big need for the Democratic committee members' version to come out. But, you know, there is still a possibility their version, their rebuttal, will come out. And I'm curious to see what the kind of wiser heads, to the extent there are any left, of the Republican Party have to say after they've had kind of a weekend to soak it up. You know, if they have some, they've been very quiet so far. Congressional Republicans are batshit, but the kind of senatorial Republicans and those kinds of people have been pretty circumspect.
McCain came out very strongly about the Menlo.
Shutting down the FBI and the Department of Justice.
It's... God. Chris, you picked one of the ones that terrifies me.
Me as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Scary thing.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that's going to do it for us. This was the February 3rd edition of Cascadian Views. Dan, JJ, thank you so much as usual. Chris, I would very much like to have you back anytime you want to be on, basically. You are incredibly informed and very insightful, and I love having a new person to talk to. Dan and JJ are probably tired of hearing my voice all the time.
Oh my gosh, thank you guys. I would love to be back sometime.
Right on.
Yeah, total pleasure, Chris.
It was great.
All right. Well, you guys have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you next week.
All right. Take care, guys. Give Abby my love, Chris.
All right. Bye.